My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is a session that I've called a Cook Tour of Recent Theology. 2 years ago, I, together with my family, were on sabbatical, and we went to East Africa. And we made arrangements through Thomas Cook, travel agency. And I never knew what a Cook's Tour was until I went down to Thomas Cook in Washington, D.C., and also found them everywhere in the world. So I found out what a Cook's Tour was. And I've used that notion for this session. As you know, if you've been on any organized tour, whether Thomas Cook's or American Express or whoever, it's going to miss as much as it's going to hit. You're only going to get to some of the many places that you would like to go to. Likewise, with this survey of recent theology, we're going to miss as much as we catch. I hope that the places we stop are the significant ones. That's what you hope for when you take one of the tours. But you also know that there's a whole lot that's significant there that you don't catch. And what I want to do is introduce you to some movements, to some books, to some authors that I'm sure are significant. I'm also sure that there are a lot of others that we will not be seeing, like on the tour, that are also significant. If you go on a Thomas Cook tour, or any of the others, and the result of that is that it only confirms what you expected to see, and you didn't see anything unexpected. It didn't change your view of some other culture or people, then that tour was, in my judgment, a failure. If the discussion today of some recent movements in theology is not a challenge to your own way of thinking about the Christian faith, then it was probably not the right tour to sign up for with Thomas Cook. If you also have a guide on your tour that never lets you ask a question, just talked all the time, and never noticed when you raise your hand or couldn't get your attention, then that wasn't a very good guide, no matter how much information that guide passed along. I hope that you will raise questions, make comments. I've been on a lot of tours when the people in the tour group knew a whole lot that was very interesting, and some things that the guide didn't know. So please raise a question. Do not regard it as an interruption. I don't like people who begin a session by saying, feel free to interrupt me. Well, if it's an interruption, you don't feel free to go ahead and make a comment. It will not be an interruption. It will be your question, your comments on the tour. So, another purpose of the tour is to find out what you want to go back and look at in greater depth. In East Africa, if you got to Nairobi and Mombasa in Kenya, or Arusha in Tanzania, and a few other places, you had some notion, even if it was a scanty overview of the terrain. You had some notion of what it is you wanted to go back to. And I hope that this tour through some recent theology will give you some notion of which books, which authors, which movements you would like to investigate on a tour of your own to follow up. I'm going to use the word theology in a very general sense. Simply, carefully stated understanding of Christian faith, thinking about the meaning of Christian faith in a rather systematic way. So that broad sense of theology, we all do theology. Some people do it as a study, and the people we'll be talking about are people who write theology, but it is the same enterprise that all of us are engaged in as Christians, namely reflecting upon the meaning of Christian faith and asking what it says to our time and place. So, then let's start. This is, as I mentioned, necessarily sketchy, but it can get filled out with your questions, comments, and the discussion at the end of the hour. With any luck at all, on your part, my voice will give out even earlier than my manuscript, and you'll have more time. The first group of theologies, I will just label ethnic theologies. And all I mean by that is that a lot of theology being written these days is written out of the experience of a particular people, using that experience as a people, not simply individuals, but as a people, an ethnos, the Greek is, an ethnic group, using that experience as a people as a major source for thinking about the Christian faith. So, we talk about black theology, or we talk about the theology of Native Americans, American Indians, or we talk about, I've got a book here called Water Buffalo Theology of All Things. It's black theology is written by blacks who look at their own experience in white-dominated cultures and ask, what does wrestling with Christian faith mean in light of our experience as a people? Or Vine and Jim Cohn's book, God of the Oppressed. I have most of the volumes here because they're in the bookstore. I've also jotted them on the board for if anyone wants to take notes. I will leave them on the board for a while if you want to come back later and jot the titles. But they are, almost all of them, in the bookstore. Jim Cohn's book, God of the Oppressed, is written by an American black who looks at the biblical material in light of his own experience as a black in this culture and does theology out of that. Vine Deloria, who incidentally graduated from Augustana Seminary in Rock Island, Illinois, an American Indian, very important leader in the Indian community, and a very, I think, important theologian. A book, God is Red. Maybe some of you read an earlier book by Deloria, which was not in theology, which was a bestseller in this country, called Custer Died for Your Sins. Yeah. Well, same fellow. He's a lawyer. He's also a theologian. Vine Deloria, God is Red. Again, now looking back at the experience of the American Indians in a white-dominated culture, but doing it as a theologian and asking, what is it in our experience as a people, as an ethnos, that what meaning is there in that for us as Christians? Kosuke Koyama, Water Buffalo Theology. Kosuke Koyama is a Japanese theologian who, however, got a Western theological education, was trained in the theology of the white and basically Protestant West. However, when he took that Western theological education as a Japanese to a ministry that he was involved in, not actually in Japan, but in Thailand, he found out that it was a whole way of looking at things that didn't really express what he saw Christian faith was about. So he began to ask, now what is it in our Oriental culture that interplays with the great themes of Christian faith? And where does it come out for us? And so he writes something called Water Buffalo Theology, an intriguing volume. Most of us as Westerners, for example, talk about what is God doing in the world? How is God working in our midst? Are we about building the kingdom of God? Those notions of working, driving, building, doing, represent a Western drive. Kosuke Koyama talks about the patience of God, the slowness of God. Did you ever think of God as being slow? Go back and read some of those biblical materials again and realize the patience and the slowness of God. Well, that's because he comes out of a different cultural experience and draws upon that in order to express Christian faith. So there's another example. of what, for lack of a better term, I'm calling ethnic theologies. That is to say, the theology is written out of the particular historical experience of a people. It's written, ethnic theologies are written by insiders. There isn't any white in this country that can write black theology. They can write a white, excuse me, they can write a white response to black theology. But only blacks write black theology. You and I can't write God is red, even if we're Christians as Vine Deloria is. It's written by an insider. We can't write water buffalo theology. Most of us don't know the difference between water buffalo and a Cape buffalo, much less what different perspectives that would give to Christian faith. Another characteristic of ethnic theologies, besides written out of an experience by an insider, is that they're written over against a dominant culture and a dominant understanding of Christian faith, by and large. That is to say, they're written by self-conscious minorities who have an experience as a minority in a culture run by somebody else. That gives them some particular perspectives on things that the rest of us often miss. The biblical materials, lots of them, are written by minorities in a minority situation. Usually, oftentimes anyway, like the Hebrews in Egypt, in an oppressive situation. So Jim Cohen, when he writes God of the Oppressed, this book is as much of a biblical exegesis as it is an expression of the black experience, because it's written by a self-conscious minority in a society run by somebody else. Or Koyama, who had to undo his education because it was one in which he received in the West. Or Vine Deloria and the experience of the American Indian. So this theology is then written by minorities over against the dominant culture and over against usually the dominant expression of the church in the culture. As such, it's often theology that is angry with that society and that expression of Christian faith. It's confrontational. And if you've ever been in settings, wherever it might be with Jim Cohen, I have great respect for Jim Cohen. He's very confrontational. And then when it's all over, he'll come up and he'll just hug you. But it's confrontational because something is really at stake there in that experience over against the dominant culture and church. Right. Yeah.
You probably know that Jim Cohen was new one.
Yeah, and it was confrontational. Yes, yeah. All week long.
Very impressive. I mean, he really made an impact.
Yeah. The first book that Jim Cohen did was called Black Power. Oh, let's see, what was it?
Black Theology.
Black Theology and Black Power. Yeah. That the word itself. I mean, they're in the title itself. You get some expression of this. They're not all confrontational, or if they are, they're often more quiet, like Koyama. But Deloria too. God is red. Okay, that's another characteristic of ethnic theologies. Oftentimes, at least recently, these ethnic theologies are self-consciously biblical. That's especially true of black theology, which takes a lot of time working with those biblical materials and seeing how they inform the black experience and how the black experience gives expression to much of biblical experience. So there are often books filled with a careful attention to biblical materials, like the Cohen volume, God of the Oppressed. Now let me focus on another set of theologies of late, the last decade and a half, which we're going to call liberation theology. I realize that most everybody these days is calling their theology liberation theology. I suspect Billy Graham is calling his theology liberation theology now. But my reference is to a particular set of theologians and a movement within the church. which comes out of Latin America. Let me say by way of an aside that the theologies I'm talking about are theologies that come out of a wider experience. I don't think it's possible to talk about black theology without at the same time knowing something of the civil rights movement, and even the black church within that of the last couple of decades. When we get to feminist theology, you must see that as a part of a wider cultural engagement with women's issues. Likewise, liberation theologies of Latin America are theologies that come out of a kind of strong movement within, especially the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America, among the poor. There's a movement called base communities, small groups within the larger church that meet together, often the poor people, doing theology in these smaller, closer communities of shared experience and wrestling with the faith. I forgot to bring down the book by Ernesto Cardenal that's in the bookstore, The Gospel in Solitamine. And it's the priest meeting with the local folks, talking about the text for the day, and they look at their own experience in this kind of close, small community of poor people, and they start seeing all sorts of things in those biblical texts for that day that are just enliven and express their situation. Well, Latin American liberation theology comes out of the movement, especially among the poor, within the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America. It's also confrontational. People who have identified with that movement have ended up, lots of them, in jail, or missing, or assassinated, as the Archbishop of El Salvador was not long ago, Romero. The theologians themselves are usually not among the poor, but they have identified with them. They usually come out of an educated class, as you might expect people who sit down and write books would. But they have identified closely with the poor. Now, a major text is Gustavo Gutierrez, A Theology of Liberation, a very sophisticated volume. Again, not something that would be something that expresses the life of the poor, but gives theological articulation to what is going on there. It's again, often self-consciously a biblical theology. That is, takes its leading images from usually the Exodus experience and an understanding of the resurrection. The Exodus is the primary formative experience for the Old Testament, the resurrection for the New, and they look at the situation of the poor in Latin America in terms of Christian faith, focusing on Exodus and resurrection out of the experience of, again, an oppressed minority. Like the ethnic theologies, they are writing as one party set over against another party. In this case, the other party, and this is always why it's confrontational for us, is usually North American domination of Latin American societies by way of what they refer to as neocolonialism, an economic domination of Latin American societies. It happens by way of an alliance of American business and military with local Latin American elites. That is, there's a class system in Latin America, rich and poor, and it sees the rich in Latin American countries in their lifestyle and in their rule in the society, whether they're business or landlord or part of the military caste, as closely identified with attachments to North America. And so this is often very confrontational over against North America. And if you want to read a very moving letter, I just thought of this at the moment and don't have the specific reference. There is an open letter to North American Christians that was written by some of these folks. It's published in Christianity in Crisis. I'll try and remember that and maybe put it up on the board here. It's also, as I've alluded to it, churchly theology originating in these groups of poor parishioners studying together with priests and teachers, and sometimes it's come out of church work in industrial missions or church social work in the slums of the large cities. It's also church theology in a different sense. The Roman Catholic Church has always taken seriously its traditions and social teachings theology and so on. And so oftentimes Latin American theology gets expressed by way of bishops gathering together and reflecting back on what the tradition means for their situation. The Roman Catholic Church, for example, has some old papal encyclicals that call for, that approve organization of labor unions. Well, in those situations, that's a volatile recommendation, and yet the bishops do it because they're taking seriously that tradition. So it's churchly theology in the sense it takes seriously church traditions. I want to mention one other feature of Latin American liberation theology. It's the one that folks like us often have a hard time with, and when you see North American criticisms of Latin American liberation theology, they often focus on the fact that these folks use a Marxist social analysis, take some cues from the Marxist tradition for understanding the dynamics of society. And I hope you've already seen that that analysis of the social dynamics, especially the economic and political dynamics, is a part of this theology. As I've alluded to it, there is then a great attention to the structures of Latin American society in which these poor Christians find themselves, and attention especially to the role of economic and social class factors, the rich-poor relationship, why it's there, what does it live from. So the conclusion often is that there is this kind of dependence of the rich and the powerful in Latin American countries upon the economic, military, and political life of dominating powers, especially North American countries, the United States. Now we can go into that, but it's important to see that this theology takes social analysis very seriously as a part of theology, as a part of the theological enterprise. It says Christian faith is incarnate, and it has to be a part of the ongoing day-to-day realities, and so we take those day-to-day realities. I hasten to add these theologians are not thoroughgoing Marxists. If by that you include an atheist viewpoint, that makes no sense whatsoever. They borrow from Marx the tools for doing social critique. I've mentioned Gutierrez, and there are many others from the Roman Catholic community. Let me mention one of the Protestants, José Viguez Bonino, the book Doing Theology in a Revolutionary Situation, published by Fortress Press, LCA Press. I personally think this is the most helpful introduction for us North Americans to Latin American liberation theology, in part because Bonino self-consciously is writing to us. He taught at Union Seminary in New York for a while. He's a major figure in the ecumenical movement. He knows us well. And he deliberately wrote a book addressed to us to interpret Latin American liberation theology, Bonino. José Viguez Bonino, Doing Theology in a Revolutionary Situation. It's a very lucid piece and a very helpful one.
Right.
Yep.
Is this liberation theology being expressed in a similar way in Africa?
Africa does have liberation theology. It is different, however, and partly because of some differing situation. Let me first explain the similarities. Black liberation theology is vital to the churches in South Africa, where the black community is poor and oppressed. So Manus Buthelezi or Alan Bosak or are a couple of black South Africans who write Black liberation theology, and it shares with Latin American liberation theology some of those dynamics. A difference is a difference of the African heritage from this heritage, which is still Western because of the influence of Western society in Latin America. So a lot of times in African liberation theology, you won't begin with the obvious parallels in the Old Testament with Exodus and oppression of Egyptians, Hebrews, because African theology is so infused with the whole notion of the created order. So it begins with a picture of God as creator, and then moves to God as liberator, whereas Latin American theologies focus primarily on God as liberator from oppression, or God of the oppressed, and releasing us from our economic and political oppression. So there are some different sources, and they relate to cultural differences.
But the Marxist influence,
yeah,
the social order, they share that one.
Well, that varies from place to place. The Marxist analysis fits the colonial situation. I mean, it really is a powerful unraveling of the dynamics in a colonial situation. So where you had white minority regimes over against a large black populace, as in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, there it enters. And you will find, especially among the youth, a younger theologian, seminarians in Zimbabwe and South Africa, strong influence of Marxism these days. Again, that social analysis. Yeah, that's a helpful parallel. I don't know. There might be others who can say something to Africans. It depends a lot upon the situation, because a lot of African countries now have their own indigenous government, and they're doing theology for their situation, as in Tanzania or Kenya or something like that. And there it's not white minority regimes. They would still talk about it as liberation theology, but it would become more closely identified with the resources in African culture.
Isn't that almost inevitable, though? Has anyone else really challenged the profit motive, Western philosophy of business? Isn't Marx the chief challenger of it? Aren't they bound to draw on him, if they don't accept all of it?
Yeah. It is the most influential, foundational critique of bourgeois society, which is characterized by commercialism and industrialism. Yeah. Yes, there haven't been other major resources. Now, you can get to some of it, but it is inevitable that you would draw, I think it's pretty near inevitable, you would draw upon that as a major critique. I think it's, let me just state again the important point here, that social analysis is a part of doing theology in this kind of thing. And that's not always been the case with a lot of theology that's been written and done, that you really view it as part of the enterprise of thinking about the meaning of Christian faith, that you engage in socioeconomic, sociopolitical criticism.
Very often in the past it was just a matter of accepting conditions as they were.
Yeah. Or regarding the domain of the spiritual, if you will, or religious, as somehow at some distance from the world of economics and politics and so on, that was a different enterprise. One of the common criticisms of both ethnic theologies and the liberation theologies of our situation is that they say we have constantly individualized and privatized the Christian faith. We've made it a matter between the self and God, and we've made it a matter of the life, the interior life of the person. And they are quick to point out that the biblical materials, all the great biblical words, are words that have to do with public life in the public domain. Covenant, kingdom, Lord. Redemption is a word from economic life. Or it's the life of jurisprudence, the law, the commandments, the covenant. Or it's from political life. Those are all public words from the public domain. And a common criticism of Western Christianity by these people is that we've individualized and privatized the faith and have lost it in the process. I mean, that's how hard they want to push the case. And part of that losing, it gets to your point. If it's been individualized and privatized, then it does not take the society terribly seriously, and it doesn't have the tools with which to do social analysis. Thus, the borrowing from Marx.
The ideas for Stuart, Vine and Laura, they are also addressed to us. Why should we read them? Well, I suppose number one is that they really do feel that that is an articulation of Christian faith that is legitimate, and we need to be self-critical about our own, and we will not be self-critical about it until someone confronts us about it. It is also a given expression to their own, working through their own culture and own tradition in a way that lays claim to them, and we need to acknowledge that. But there certainly are this. Okay, let me, again, this is I remind you, a quickie tour. What, this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium kind of tour. And this is Monday, it must be feminist theology next. Feminist theology, like the others, is also a theology of group experience, where that experience is one of the prime sources of theology. If that sounds sort of common sense to you, I want to remind you that a lot of theology has not taken the experience, the concrete experience of a group, seriously in an explicit way. You've done theology by asking, what are the biblical materials and what is the dogmatic tradition? Without asking, what does it mean to be white and male in one's doing a theology? Or to be middle class and Republican or Democrat in one's doing theology? So it has not been the case that a lot of theology has taken seriously as one of the major sources the group experience. Feminist theology does that from beginning to end. What does it mean to be woman in this time and place, and what has it meant in history as a major resource for theology? Instead of sort of arriving at right doctrine by cool logic or starting from creedal confessions judged sound regardless of their time or place or the people involved or biblical revelation, this is doing it differently. Like the others, you might guess, there's another party involved in this one too. And it's this time male-dominated society. And there's a common critique that runs through feminist theology that goes roughly like this. It says that our Western society has been dominated by a particular way of looking at the world, a hierarchical way. Hierarchical means things are ordered in a pattern of up and down, and where things farther up are of greater value than things lower in the ladder. In this picture, God is regarded as on top of this sort of cosmic ladder, of this ordering effect, and God is identified as spirit. And the bottom of this ladder is matter, inert matter. And the universe is stretched out between matter at the bottom and God as spirit at the top. Now it's ordered in that. And between there's an ordering. And in that scheme, we have regarded the matters of the soul and matters that are spiritual as higher on this ladder than matters of the body and material matters. And so we have felt the soul is above the body, or matters of the spirit are above mere material matters. We have said reason is higher than emotion, is more trustworthy than emotion. Or the mind is above, and quote, that means closer to God than the body, which is identified as closer to matter and matter of the flesh. In this theme, we have also said that men are higher in this scale than women. And those characteristics, a reason being higher than emotion, and men and women are then correlated. So men are more rational, and women are more intuitive and emotional. So men should be free. And women have their place, but it's a different place. Men have their place, but it's a higher place. Well, this way of looking at things results in a hierarchical way of looking at the world that is also patriarchal. And the feminist critique says that has dominated our religious life and that has dominated our culture. Spirit or mind over body. Reason higher value than emotion and male, the rational and the spiritual, or above the female. And these interlock and produce a particular culture, and then Western culture in the feminist critique is a culture of what you might call a driving male giantism. It likes the hard challenge. It doesn't like things that are soft. It likes the work, and it likes to conquer, and it likes to control. Amory Lovin published a book called Soft Energy Path, which was a book about how he wanted to see things like solar and wind, and tidal, or use of the seas and so on, benign energy sources, replace dependence upon nuclear and fossil fuels, which he called hard energy path. Margaret Mead told Amory Lovin it was unfortunate that he chose those words hard and soft for his energy path, because the people that are going to be making decisions about energy are going to be middle class and above white males, and they don't like anything soft. They like something hard. And there was, I have a poem that I carry around in my back pocket by Carl Sandburg called Chicago. And I'll just read it to you. Chicago is here a kind of short hand for a driving male giantism. And listen to the images in the poem, because this would be a macho poem in the light of feminist theologian perception of society. Chicago. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamp, luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I say, yes, it is true, I've seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. Well, there are only two images of women in this poem. One is a victim, along with the children, and the other is a luring farm boy. And having answered, so I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer, and then I say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning. Flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job, here the tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little, soft city. I'm a disdain in that line. The little, soft city. That's a feminine world. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action. Cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness. Bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. You ever been to Chicago? That's what happened. New York City has a new committee for downtown Manhattan. I just chuckled when I saw the name of it. Some citizens were getting concerned about the building boom in midtown Manhattan, what it was doing to the neighborhood. they organized a committee, and it's the Committee for a Balanced Building Boom.
I thought it was just wonderful. The first thing they said, we're not against the building boom, we're just against, we want a balanced building. Wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth. Under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle. Bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse, and under his ribs the heart of the people laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. Well, that's what's meant by a kind of driving male giantism. A kind of way of looking at the world in terms of conquest and control. I see our time is going. I'll tell you one more story. I see Eunice back there, and I'm reminded of our time in Tanzania. We went with some friends and climbed Kilimanjaro in down again, a 5-day ordeal, and an American acquaintance in Arusha, Tanzania, said to me when we got down, he said, "Hey, you really made it. You conquered Kilimanjaro." Well, I'll show you a slide sometime of Kilimanjaro and of me. You can determine which one conquered. It was a kind of natural thing for an American to say. Because we also talk about conquering space. And think of that image. Current stargazing slides tonight of galaxies far beyond ours. And think about conquering space. Or even though when we talk about benign energy sources, we talk about harnessing the sun for solar power. Think of that image. What does it mean to harness the sun? Oh yeah, that's like conquering Kilimanjaro. Well, this is a long way around. Feminist theologies have this common critique of male-dominated Western culture that is hierarchical, that is patriarchal, and that is this domineering kind of way of looking at things. And then they try to say that this mindset of Western religion and culture in a male mode is not the way in which to image Christian faith most faithfully. There are some other ways and other understandings of Christian faith, and then it goes on.
I like the reaction on one page of it tonight, ethics theology and liberation theology sort of sprang from within the church, from the Christian people, looking at the problem.
Yeah.
But the one that we're talking about now, it sort of came from outside.
No, both within and without, and that was my earlier point. Even the ethnic theologies, I don't think we understand the black theology apart from the civil rights movement, which is deep church roots. I mean, you think of Martin Luther King. But likewise, feminist theology is part of a wider movement of women's issues, but also with self-consciously Christian women articulating their faith within this wider context.
Thank you.
I want to commend to you a couple of texts. Rosemary Ruther's New Woman, New Earth, Sexist Ideologies and Human Liberation. You can just tell from that title, New Woman, New Earth, that Rosemary Ruther sees a connection between the way in which we have treated the environment and nature and the way in which males are treated females. There is a common dynamic. That's the critique of a Western kind of mindset. That is also expressed in a book by Elizabeth Dobson Gray called The Green Nigger, where she says the dynamics of male and female in our kind of society are similar to the dynamics of humanity over nature. So, New Woman, New Earth. And then a book which I frankly have not read. I know that it's being widely used in seminaries these days, and some of you may know it, and I'm glad to hear from you about it. Edited by Carol Christie and Judith Plasko, Woman's Spirit Rising, a feminist reader in religion. It's a, as it sounds like, and it's co-editor, it's a collection of essays. The essential challenge, does theology speak to women's experience? Remember what I said about group experience. The past, does it hold a future for women? The third section, reconstructing tradition, working through the whole Christian heritage again in this perspective. And then the fourth section, creating new traditions. So that's something then about feminist theology. And let me mention then what we'll call the new evangelicalism. All of these things do not have sharp lines between them. But a few years back, over a Thanksgiving weekend, and in the 60s, late 60s, a group of folks coming from what we loosely call the evangelical camp in American religious life, which is not a long denominational line, but people who would call themselves, for example, born again Christians, a group of them got together in Chicago, and the outcome of that weekend together was a document called the Chicago Declaration. The gist of it was that there had been in American life a link between conservative theology and conservative politics. So people who held theological conservatism, by and large, were associated with conservative politics in this country, whether it expressed itself as Republican politics or in the South with conservative Democratic politics among evangelicals. This group in Chicago says that is not where we as evangelicals stand. We stand somewhere else. And what we mean by evangelical Christianity is something that breaks not only with conservative politics in the United States, but really is a kind of radical countercultural politics. So this new evangelicalism then found some expression in its own media. The magazine Christianity Today or Eternity or Billy Graham's magazine Decision were not the vehicle for the new evangelicalism, although they came from that common background and out of that camp. Rather, a new magazine, which was first called, interestingly enough, the Post-American, and is now Sojourn magazine, became a voice, or the smaller one, and a little more on the lighter side, the other side. And I'll mention a couple of books. Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourner, published a book, which is again available in the bookstore, called Agenda for Biblical People, a new focus for developing a lifestyle of discipleship. This comes out of the evangelical camp. Historically, let me explain it a little bit. It isn't now any longer for these people, evangelicals, trying to use Walter Rauschenbusch's title of the book, Christianize the whole social order, win everyone to Christ, that all might be born anew or born again, Christianize the social order by prayer breakfast and by being good friends with the president or converting city council, or presiding over East Room Sunday services in the White House. Not that. Not Billy Graham being close friends with Richard Nixon. Not that tax. Or not even electing a Christian to the White House, the born again Christian. That's not the new evangelicalism. Rather, by clustering small groups of zealous Christians together in communities that are highly disciplined, involved in common sharing, and that also engage city hall or the government or whatever, but usually in more confrontational kinds of politics, on behalf, say, for example, housing for the poor. So it's really a kind of rebirth, as you know, something of Christian history of Calvinists and Anabaptists, covenantalism and sectarianism, a kind of left wing of the Reformation come the 20th century America. The book that has, the scholarly work that has kind of hit a home run here, that's been very influential, is John Howard Yoder's volume, The Politics of Jesus. Again, available in the bookstore. If I had three books to recommend to you on recent theology of great significance, I would recommend Yoder's Politics of Jesus and Rosemary Luther's New Woman, New Earth, and Gutierrez or Bonino on Liberation Theology. This is a genuine a threshold volume for understanding a movement now which we're just roughly calling a new evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a minute, the library of the word Anabaptist.
Yeah. Well,
a lot
thank
of us
you.
That had very negative
yeah.
because Luther railed against the Anabaptist.
You call them the Schwärmerei, the enthusiasts, all these spirit-filled people who are going off and doing crazy things. So Luther came down very hard against Anabaptists. Anabaptist means that they needed to be baptized again, a sign of being born again, even though they were baptized once. What we have out of the Anabaptist tradition are groups, for example, like the Mennonites. But that was, there were two reformations that happened in the 16th century, both of them against the Roman Catholic Church. There was what's called the Imperial Reformation, which is Luther and Calvin. And it's called imperial because they linked arm with the princes, with the officials of empire, in order to reform the church. So Luther made appeal to the princes. There was another reformation, and that was against both the Roman Catholic Church and against the Imperial Reformation. That's often called the left wing of the Reformation or the radical Reformation. They said Luther did not go far enough. Justification by grace through faith is correct, but Luther shouldn't have suppressed the peasant revolt with the prince's army when the peasants revolted against the continuation of the rule of the princes here and there. And they, for a variety of reasons, some of them theological, most of them theological, there was that group of called Anabaptists. And a lot of small what are for us denominations came out of it. The Mennonite Churches, brethren, in this country. Now that's not all of those that belong to New Evangelicalism, because the Baptists, as we know them, both the Southern Baptists and the American Baptists, come out of England and not out of the left wing of the Reformation on the continent. But that is some. And Yoder is a Mennonite writing this volume. Okay, then, just to quickly then, and to finish up, let me just mention some responses to these theologies, ethnic theologies, liberation theologies in Latin America, feminist theology, and New Evangelicalism. Some of the responses have been responses from the people who are being addressed, namely, especially white Western male, or at least white Western male-dominated societies. And one of the responses to that has been to take these critiques as seriously as one can, and then say something back to them, not simply defensively, but engaging in a real discussion of what does Christian faith mean, having you said what you said to me, and so on. One of those volumes, which takes them seriously, even though it doesn't address them all in a direct sort of way, is a book by Douglas John Hall, Light in Our Darkness. This book was a theme book at Holden 2 summers ago. Douglas John Hall is a Canadian, and he does a critique of North American culture in light of these other critiques, and also he has a heavy influence in German theology, And then he does a critique of North American Christianity in light of the various critiques that have been made of it. And then he responds with a constructive theological response of his own. And interestingly enough, at that point, calls for the subtitle, Toward an Indigenous Theology of the Cross, draws upon Luther, especially, and says, what we need is no longer a theology of mastery and success. That's what our North American Christianity has been, one way or another. Luther called that a theology of glory. What we need is a theology of the cross, a theology in which God comes as the weak one. Okay, that's one kind of response. An insider to the Western male-oriented society that then addresses that society. Another kind of response has been an interpretive one. That is, someone who stands in the tradition more common to those of us gathered in this room and interprets what these other things are to do, other critiques are saying to us. And that volume isn't in the bookstore, but let me commend it to you. Robert McAfee Brown's volume, Theology in a New Key. He says the Latin Americans especially, that's what he's drawing upon, but also the feminists in black theology, are writing theology in a new key. It's new to us. It's not the familiar tune. He uses a musical analogy all the way through. It's a well written. It's a theology in a new key. And he is just going to act as an interpreter of that, because he hears it in a culture that is more akin to yours and mine. And he will do that. That's a very readable account. Okay. And those are two sorts of responses, the interpretive one and the constructive response. I think that maybe we'll just sort of quit there.